This morning, if you look at your bulletins, you'll see the sermon title and the passage, Welcome to the Wilderness. So that can be taken a number of ways. Both physically, in the sense of being in a kind of removed location, also, in a very true spiritual sense, of we each find ourselves at times kind of in a spiritual wilderness. We don't have a sense of God's presence. We may feel alone. We may very much be facing incredible obstacles in our lives, and I think that's by design. I think that God, I know for a fact that God intentionally allows or causes troubles in our lives to build our understanding of our own frailties and our own reliance on Him. And this often comes through through experience. Another way to think about experience is history, right? So a huge percentage of my life, I have been a student. So I look around this room and I see a lot of people that are still formally and currently students. And when I think about that, and I think about this idea of history, I remember a phrase, well, really a truth that I've heard from a number of people. Maybe you've heard the same thing. This idea that, hey, I used to find history so boring, but then I had this teacher, this history teacher that just made it come alive. So maybe you've had that experience. Maybe you've been that person who said that. I have been that person who has said that. I remember having a teacher, I think his name was Mr. Wright, in the eighth grade. And always initially, before that, found history to be very boring. It's like, you know, why am I learning all these facts of the past? What does it have to do with me? And today I realize that really, really God has been and still is that kind of a teacher, like my Mr. Wright, who makes history come alive. So when we have those moments of recognizing the validity and importance of history, we can ask ourselves what makes history lessons engaging? A lot of answers potentially for that. Sometimes it's the vivid detail making you feel like you're really there in that story. Sometimes it's the tension of not knowing what's about ready to happen in that historical story. I think for us, as we reread biblical stories, sometimes it's the realization that this biblical story is really my family story. Many are fascinated by their family ancestry, their family tree, their family heritage, asking questions like, where did I come from? Where did my ancestors come from? I've spoken with a number of people, even just over this last year, who have been fascinated and spent a good deal of time and resources investigating their own family history, their own family tree. We have a benefit that the Bible does that for us. It tells us about our family history and our family tree. In another way, some are fascinated by history as it relates to them and how it has, in very practical ways, impacted their daily lives. And this may be learning in our situation the history of the development of something as simple as the Kenai Peninsula, where we live. Or the history of your church, or something more personal, the history of your own immediate and extended family. Maybe the history of alcoholism in your family, or the history of divorce or abuse, or maybe even some positive things. Good counselors, given time, will delve deeply into these related family histories because we are connected. We're connected to those around us. We're connected to our history, and it tells us a lot about who we are, our influences. I think, though, in our situation here at Redeemer, we are motivated to think about our spiritual history, because, you know, we think about where are we from, what connects us to one another. We think about the history of God with his people. It's been said, those who cannot remember the past are doomed to repeat it. And there's truth to that. But what does that have to do with our faith in God, our daily trust in him, to follow him? So I kind of put that to you this morning as you're sitting there in your burgundy seat, to ask yourself, why do I trust in God? Why do you trust in God? I assume that most of you, if you verbalized those answers, would give some kind of reason that would be connected to history. This is what I know. I trust God because this is what he's done for me. This is what he has done for my family. All of that is history. It's a reliance on factual, verifiable experience that God has done to you, through you, and with those that you care about. God speaks through history. In other words, he speaks through stories. And in the Old Testament, the main story is about God and his people. So take a moment and think about that. Think about the Old Testament. And when you think about the Old Testament from Genesis to Malachi, so much of it is a story. It's a series of stories woven together. It's a history book. I mean, really, if you read the Old Testament, you're starting in Genesis chapter 1, and you read to Malachi, it is a story, a history, about how God interacts with his people. It's really what it is. It's not predominantly a list of rules and regulations and doctrines, although those things are there to provide clarification and governance of God's people. And so that's significant for us to recognize, because that's our history. In Romans 2 and Romans 4 and many other places in our New Testament, you have the Apostle Paul and others saying that history that you're reading about in the Old Testament about Israel and what God's doing with them, that's your history. That's you. He says, if you have the faith of Abraham, then you're a child of Abraham. If you believe and trust in God, then you are, using the language of Romans, the end of Romans chapter 2, you're a Jew. A Jew is a Jew who is one inwardly. So that's your history. That's your heritage. That's your family tree. And that's important, because I think a lot of the motivation that people have in digging into their roots is to get a sense of identity, to get a sense of not just me, myself, and I, but a sense of foundation, perspective. So, you want to understand where you spiritually come from and how God interacts with people like you, then that's where we go. We go as a starter to the old covenant. And we are swamped. We are infiltrated. We are inundated with story after story after story after story about the people of God facing problems, their response predominantly is fear. Sometimes they respond well, sometimes they don't. But then the end of that story always is God rescues them. God gives them what they needed. God gives them what they were so afraid. They were so afraid that they weren't going to get. We need that story. We need that history. Because we are prone to doubt. We are prone to fear. Read your history. Read your family ancestry. We are so prone to fear. If you just take a moment in your own life right now, what's going on in your life that would give you or motivate you to fear? What are you anxious about? It's the story of God's people facing a problem, fearing, and then God provides the answer. So, I'm going to put before you this morning four questions. They're already printed for you in your bulletins. Number one, do you remember your history and mine? These are questions posed from the perspective of God. So, do you remember your history and mine, meaning God's history? Do you trust me? Do you remember me? And finally, what does this mean for us in our current chapter of this story that God is telling? So first, do you remember your history in mind. So you'll see the passage this morning. I was not completely transparent when I put the passage down as Numbers 10 through Deuteronomy, because I wanted to communicate maybe a smaller passage than what we'll actually be covering. I thought it might scare you a little bit, thinking, oh, can you really cover all of that in one message? So, for context to Numbers 10 through the rest of Deuteronomy, we'll start in Genesis. Genesis chapter 3. What happens in Genesis chapter 3? Yeah. The fall, right? With a capital F, you have Adam and Eve. They fall into sin. The first real image of the people of God in struggle. What's their response when they sinned? You think they were afraid? Yeah. Their first response was to hide. They hid from the presence of God. They hid from him. Realized that they were naked, and what was God's response? He provided clothing for them. God's response was to care for them. There was a separation, right? So they had to leave the garden as a predominantly a symbolic reflection of where there is sin, there is separation. But still, he took care of them. And what's the next thing that happened in the story of Adam and Eve? They had children, right? They had children. Two of them are mentioned by name initially. Cain and Abel. And as God's people, what happens with Cain and Abel? In connection with their parents being Adam and Eve, one murders the other. I tried to imagine what that would be like to be Adam, for example, and to have two sons, and to have one of them literally murder the other one out of a fit of rage and jealousy. I don't know. I don't know what that would be like. I can't wrap my mind around what that would be like. Because not only are you losing a child who is now dead, but now the other one, you know, is a murderer. There's your heritage as a parent. And this was coming from the perspective of a man and woman who had perfect fellowship with God. And this is their situation. The history of the people of God. Your history. God always provided a way through even the most difficult of circumstances. The story continues. We see people continue to fall away from following God to the point where you have Noah and his family. The rest suffer their fate after, during the flood. You have, following the flood, you have the Tower of Babel, and then you have Kind of really the first truly bright spot in this set of historical stories, which is Abraham, right? So God, he comes to Abraham and he gives him this promise in Genesis 12 and 15 and 17, reiterated. And he says, I am going to provide a redeemer. I'm going to provide a savior. And that is going to happen through you, through a people, I'm going to multiply you. And he says that to Abraham and by extension, Sarah. And they struggle with belief. Why do they struggle with belief? Because of the obstacles in front of them, the trouble, right? So they have these promises of God, but then in their life, they see how they might define as reality. They see, okay, well, the spiritual truth is this. God says this, but look at the reality. The reality is, I'm 100 years old, and my wife is 100 years old, and we're going to have kids. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, there's trouble, and there's doubt, and there's fear, and they resort to ungodly means to try to make it work. God's response, he still provides. He still gives them what he promised. And Abraham has a son, Isaac. Isaac and his wife, similar problem, still God provides. And he ends up with twins, Jacob and Esau. And there is great fear there, right? So Jacob also tries to accomplish God's will through dysfunctional means by tricking his brother, and then is in great fear of his brother Esau. And the result of that ends up being God is still in control and God still provides for them. So Jacob, who is renamed as Israel, one who struggles with God. I think that's a very wonderfully accurate name for the one who kind of symbolizes the forefather of the people of God as one who struggles with God. And he has 12 sons, and they then are, if you remember the story, they go to Egypt because of a famine, right? So big obstacle, big trouble, big threat, they're afraid. So what do? They go to Egypt. And through Joseph and the Pharaoh at the time, they provide for them through God's providence, and they end up multiplying there in Egypt for 400 years. God gave them a promise. Genesis 15:13-14. Then the Lord said to Abraham, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in the land that is not theirs, and will be slaves there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterwards they shall come out with great possessions. That would have been hard to be the people of God because you see all the trouble. You see all the things that you're facing, all the struggles that you're going through. Not in theory. In real life, every single day. But you have this promise. And you're trying to cling to the promise. Again, that's the history of the people of God. That's your history. And what happens? God keeps his word, and he does deliver them against all odds, against all reason, against all human powers. God comes through Moses to deliver his people. I don't know what a fair comparison would be today in our life. America is a bit of a superpower. We're not so godless as Egypt. Imagine maybe America with 10 times its military and economic strength, and you have some who has enslaved a certain type of people group, and then you have some no-name, tiny country from East Africa, no military to speak of, and they're like, we're going to liberate our ancestors from you. We're going to take you down unless you release them. It's laughable. It's absolutely laughable. In the biblical story, not only does God overthrow this ultimate superpower by slaves, well, in a sense, he does it on display, because that is the main point. The main point is that God reveals himself as the great deliverer of his people. So he has Moses come in, and Aaron, and there are these God orchestrated these miracles in such a way so that it would be a public display. It wasn't a matter of some individual, like, personal secret blackmail with the Pharaoh. It was, do this, and then the entire nation sees the power of God to deliver his people. The entire Nile River system being turned to blood. Nationwide plagues of locusts, of frogs, of hail. I can't think of a more dramatic way for God to make a point. The superpower of the planet at that point being laid waste in every single way, religiously, physically, economically, on behalf of these slaves. God will provide for his people. That is your history. That is your heritage. That's your lineage. you are a part of that same people. Facing what seems in human terms as being impossible. Humanly speaking, how could this situation be resolved at work or with my spouse or with my child or with my parent? How could that possibly happen? How could God possibly take care of me in this situation? I'm looking at the facts. I'm a reasonable person. I'm looking at what's in front of me right now, this week. Can you imagine what the Israelites were looking at? God glories in blowing our expectations. And so, through all of that, he guides them out, pillar of cloud by day, pillar of fire by night. Then they come to the border of the Red Sea. The Egyptians are hot on their tail. And the response of God's people at this point to all of this is reflected beautifully in Exodus 14:12, their response to God and to Moses. Didn't we tell you this would happen while we were still in Egypt? We said, "Leave us alone, let us be slaves to the Egyptians. It's better to be a slave in Egypt than a dead body in the wilderness." Sometimes we struggle with faith, and we struggle to think about what God has already done for us in the past. They had just seen and experienced all these things that God had delivered them from, and yet they're faced with a new trial. Oh, there's water in front of us. We can't cross it. We have bad guys coming up behind us. What are we going to do? We're all going to die. What obstacle are you facing? What has God already delivered you from? What has God done in your life up until this point? Remember your history. And remember your family history. God's response in this situation. He parts the Red Sea, wipes out the Egyptian military force. We read in Exodus 14:30, "That is how the Lord rescued Israel from the hand of the Egyptians that day, and the Israelites, and remember, they just got through complaining to God, saying, you know, it's better to be a slave in Egypt than to be a dead body in the desert. And here we read, "And the Israelites saw the dead bodies of the Egyptians washed up on the seashore." So that happened. A little bit more history. 3 days later, after that event, Exodus 15:22, what happens? They became hungry. And what was their response? Their response was to grumble and to complain against God and to complain against Moses. And so God miraculously provides manna for them. This wonderful food from heaven. It's kind of a honey tasting wafer. But then they became thirsty. And so we read from Exodus 17:3, but the people were thirsty and they grumbled against Moses. They said, "Why did you bring us out of Egypt to make us, our children, and our livestock die of thirst?" God's response, he didn't just strike them dead, which would have been the temptation at that point, I'm sure. He provided living water for them in a miraculous way. This is your history, this is your heritage, and this is mine. Facing trials, facing difficulties, living in fear, and then God providing again. Again, shortly after this, we see in Numbers 10, verses 1, and also chapter 11, Numbers 11, 1. Soon the people began to complain about their hardship. They began to crave the good things of the lower 48. They began to crave the good things of Egypt and complained, "Oh, for some meat," they exclaimed. "All we ever see is this manna." And the Lord became exceedingly angry. And God said, this is God's response to his people. He didn't just wipe them off of the face of the earth. He was angry. Very appropriate expression to communicate God's displeasure of their response. God said, "Tell the people that tomorrow you will all have meat to eat. You were whining, and the Lord heard you. We want meat," you said. "We were better off in Egypt," you said. "Now the Lord will give you meat, and you will eat it for a whole month until you gag and are sick of it." Moses asked, "How can this be?" Right? How could this be? They're out in the wilderness. How are you going to provide like a staggering amount of meat for this entire nation for a month? How are you going to do that? It's not possible. We're reasonable people. We're looking at what's going on around us. We're not fools. We see what's going on. How could that possibly happen? Our fear is justified. Our anxious thoughts are justified. Moses himself asked, "How can this be?" Then the Lord said to Moses, "Has my arm lost its power? Now you'll see if my word comes true." Then the Lord sent a wind that brought quail from the sea, and they fell all around the camp for miles, about 3 feet above the ground. Isn't that just like our God? To blow our expectations again in the face of fear from his people, to give them what they need, even though they struggled to really believe and to have faith. that gives me peace, that gives me confidence and courage, knowing my own struggles of being anxious in circumstances. Again, this is our history. This is our heritage. And so, because of God's provision, they go in and they come to the land and they go in and they just settle the land peaceably in trust. No, they don't. They don't do that. They don't do that. In fact, even after God's provision, all these different examples, they come to the border of the promised land, finally, after Mount Sinai and all the rest of it, and they're like, I really don't know about this, so let's send in 12 spies, one representing each of the 12 tribes of Israel, and we'll see if this is really doable. So they send them in, and what happens? They see trouble. They see obstacles, don't they? And 10 of the 12, representing the northern tribes, they say, oh, it's so scary. We're all going to die if we go in, right? Common story. Again, this is the natural story, our story. And they struggled to believe, thinking, oh no, the troubles that we might face that God has led us into is going to be the end of us. We see from Numbers 14, chapter 14, verse 1, then the whole community began weeping aloud. So this is after the report came back. And even though 10 said, no, this is undoable, there are large, tall Glovers in the land, these huge people. So two people said, we can do this. So the whole community began weeping aloud, and they cried all night. Verse 2, if only we had died in Egypt, or even here in the wilderness, they complained. Why is the Lord taking us to this country only to have us die in battle? Then they plotted, let's choose a new leader and go back to Egypt. Verse 10, and the whole community began to talk about stoning Joshua and Caleb. Well, that was reasonable, wasn't it? After all, they had eyes. They were reasonable people. They could see the circumstances on the ground. They could see how weak they were. They could see how strong the Palestinians were. The only reasonable thing was to be afraid and to retreat and to silence those who were saying, we can do this. Trust God. That lack of faith that they exhibited was so great that God could not allow them to enter the promised land, because again, God speaks through history. He speaks through stories. He speaks through parables and pictures. And the picture was that the true people of God will enter into the promised land. Who are the people of God? The people of God are the people who trust and believe in God, It's why the New Testament authors spend so much time talking about what does it mean to be a Christian? It's one who believes, who trusts, who follows God. And it's based on that trust and that faith, which is a gift, that God will usher us into the kingdom of God now and the final kingdom, heaven. And so those people could not enter into that promised land. It would destroy the entire picture of a people who trusted God would enter the promised land of God's rest. So, fast forward 40 years. After wandering around the desert, they come back, and that's where we end up with Deuteronomy. So, you know, you talk about the first five books of the Bible, Deuteronomy, that's them at that threshold again, Kadesh Barnea. They're on that border. What's going to happen now? What are they going to do? Are they going to believe? Are they going to go in? So that's where you get this whole retelling, the retelling of the law, of God's principles, God's standards. And he says, trust me. Will you trust me? Those are kind of these two questions that he asks them. Do you trust me? Will you simply look around at your circumstances to dictate your emotional state, your view of God? And he's saying, again, trust me, unlike what happened 40 years ago, we see from Deuteronomy, I mean, really from the very beginning, the very first chapter of Deuteronomy, verse 27, God reminds them of their history, and he says, and you murmured in your tents and said, because the Lord hated us, he has brought us out of the land of Egypt to give us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. Again, just reminding them, hey, this is kind of a pattern here with you guys, so remember what has happened. The other question is, do you remember me? Do you really remember me? Do you remember what God has done? From Psalm 77, and again, as we know, the Psalms are kind of a natural reflection, a spiritual reflection of believers to God in a positive way. So Psalm 77, we read the heart cry of the psalmist, I will remember the deeds of the Lord. And we have to tell ourselves that over and over again. I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your wonders of old. I will ponder all your work and meditate on your mighty deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. It's a wonderful thing to use the Psalms as a guide for our own prayer life, because this story isn't new. This is an old story. This is our heritage. This is our history. The psalmist is one of your own. And he realized that he needed to pray a prayer like this. I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your wonders of old. I will ponder all your work. I will meditate on your mighty deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. as the people of God were again on the threshold of entering the promised land for the second time. We read God's message to them from Deuteronomy. He says, from Deuteronomy 6, "Listen closely, Israel, and be careful to obey. Then all will go well with you, and you will have many children in the land, flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord promised you. And you must love the Lord your God with all of your heart, all your soul, and all your strength. Repeat them again and again to your children. Talk about them when you're at home and when you're on the road, when you're going to bed and when you're getting up. Tie them to your hands and wear them on your foreheads as reminders. Write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." Do everything that you possibly can to not forget, to remember. What does that mean? It means, literally, when you get up in the morning, think about these things. Pray. Have family devotions. Have personal times with the Lord. Memorize Scripture. Let this govern your conversations. Find times throughout the week to get into true Christian kind of conversations. Because this is our history. Our history is one of forgetting and of being afraid and not remembering what God has done. Finally, what does this mean for our current chapter in this story of God's people? Just a few really quick, obvious reminders. You know, first and foremost, be grateful for these tough things that God puts you through. I know it's tough. No one escapes it. You know, if you think about, oh, well, this person has it so easy, or that person across the aisle, or in that chair over there, they have it so great. God does not let any of his children escape the struggles of this life. Everyone struggles. I've been reminded of that this week. You know, you've got people, they seem like they've got it all together. But there's struggles behind the surface that you just don't know. Money, position, influence. No one escapes the struggles of this life. And it is through those struggles that God brings us closer to himself. It's through those things that he makes us stronger. There is no strengthening without exercise. There's no strengthening spiritually without going through things requiring perseverance. Deuteronomy, again, chapter 8, verse 2. God led you through the wilderness, humbling you and testing you to prove your character and obedience. Yes, he humbled you by letting you go hungry and then feeding you manna. He did it to teach you that people do not live by bread alone. Rather, We live by every word that comes from the mouth of God. That if you recognize that, yes, that's what Jesus quoted when he was being tempted, by Satan. The very next verse, just as a parent disciplines a child, the Lord, your God, disciplines you for your own good. In your struggles, realize that these struggles are from the hand of God to train you. Just because it's hard doesn't mean it's wrong. James 1, 2 through 4, consider it all joy, my brothers, when you encounter different types of trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And this endurance will have its perfect result, that you may be mature and complete, lacking in nothing. I think I'll just close with this. What do we know that God has communicated to us that should make us strong, that will help us persevere through all of these things? And there's so many truths. Here are a few that just kind of encapsulate some of this. You are adopted by the Father of the universe. You are royalty, whether you feel it or not. You have an eternal, everlasting, imperishable inheritance, which is reserved in heaven for you. Let that sink in. One of my all-time favorite passages is from Galatians 2:20. For I have been crucified with Christ, and it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me, and delivered himself up for me. In the context of that family connection, we think of Romans 8:31. What shall we say then to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? What a lesson, right? What a lesson for the people of God. The Israelites facing Egypt. If God is for us, who can be against us? And it's not just in a, obviously, military sense. It's in a personal, relational sense, because our two greatest enemies are what? Sin and death. Jesus Christ conquered those on your behalf. The life that we have. And so with that, we pause and we reflect on that relationship that we have with the Father through the Son, empowered by the Holy Spirit. We recognize the dysfunction of our family heritage. You recognize in our DNA, if you will, our struggles, our propensities. But we see how God has responded to his people as they struggle with things like fear and doubt. And we pray to him that he will give us greater faith and greater belief as we meditate on the revelation that he has given us through this history. So with that, join me in prayer.